Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Hi there, folks, and welcome to Strength to Be Human. This is episode number 9, but it's also the first episode I'm doing with interviews. It's going to be a regular segment of our show that we're going to interview interesting people in the arts. They could be writers, they could be poets, but anyone in the arts that is interesting, has something important to say, I like to have them on this show. Right now, I have Linda Imbula, someone I've known for quite some time. She's a Kansas-based poet and writer, and also a musician, a retired teacher, practitioner of yoga and Tai Chi. She has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize in Poetry and the Best of the Net Prize, some of the big ones that are out there. So I'm very excited to have her on the show. Welcome, Linda. Thank you for being on.
Thank you, Mark, for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm excited.
All right. I am going to talk today about writing as a craft and get into some of the more detailed things. As a student of the writing craft, I've only written publicly for 4 years, but I have learned a great deal. And one of the things that I have learned through working through this craft with my tools and following a process is that small is better. So that's kind of the motto of the show today is writing's a craft and small is better. By that, I mean that I always use small steps that are necessary to get started in writing whatever I'm writing. And it, even as a person's writing improves and gets better, they all continue to use these small steps in order to improve. A lot of times these steps are conscious. Sometimes they're unconscious. So it just kind of depends. I also wanted to start out a little bit and talk about what I mean by creativity. What are the standard markers of creativity? And these are research-based, and these are things that everybody knows. But since the show's kind of moving into talking about creativity with creative people, these are things that all people who have the creative gene do. They always make unique connections between seemingly contrasting or unrelated ideas, doing common things in an uncommon way. People who are creative tend to find hidden patterns or change patterns. And I personally like to change patterns into a way that I find appealing. So I'm not trying to be conceited here, but I'm going to tie all this back to me since this is a show about my writing process and my creative process.
Oh, no, it makes sense to me. In fact, that's exactly what you should do, and what I'm going to encourage other folks to do is if you're going to outline a way of going about things, if it's not just in your life or maybe in how you creative do things, then you should actually provide a few examples. Or just simply make the statement, yeah, this is exactly what I do. That's why I'm talking about it. Because it would make no sense to me, and maybe even to audience, to spend 20 minutes on a theory, and then you're like, well, this is a theory. I don't actually do that. That's not really helpful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I will give specific examples under each of the steps, on especially on the task analysis part, which I'll talk about in a minute, on what I do and what I don't do. Creative people always tend to create something new out of something old. They don't copy, they don't plagiarize, but they look at things that have been done. And it kind of ties into another aspect of creativity, and that's to understand what is regular or normal. Some people call it conventional, status quo. What are some of those patterns that are out there already that you take and you stand them on their head or you turn them inside out. That's where you really get the artistic part of this craft, is turning things inside out or on their head.
I like that a lot. I know you. I like that statement. I like the thinking behind it, because I think it makes sense to me when you have to counter somebody that says, well, listen, Shakespeare already did everything, so what the heck can I do that's going to make any difference? And I always remind people that, yeah, Shakespeare did a lot of things, but he doesn't live in 2019, and we have cars and jets, and we got instruments flying to other planets. So there are plenty of things that you can write, talk about, and think about that he could never do that. So don't say that someone has done all this already, because that's really not the case.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's all this talk right now about putting someone on Mars. Well, I'm sorry, we haven't done that yet, but there's a lot of what ifs and a lot of can do's in that. So and speaking of space and things like that, something that I had read once was that the natural state of the universe is darkness. But here comes the old sun to turn the earth on its, you know, the sun comes and turns the earth on its head and gives us daylight. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, wow, that's pretty, that's one way to really think about it. You know, it really is. How do I personally know what regular is? You know, I think I know by reading and observing and listening, using all my senses to observe my environment. And then I tend to categorize things. I know some people aren't really list makers and categorizers. I tend to be. That's how I learn to subvert the ordinary. Creative people and have a great attention to detail. I remember being in college. I ran into an old high school friend who was an artist, a painter, beautiful, wonderful painter. And, he said, Linda, how many steps are there going up to the second floor? Just out of the blue. I thought, well, I don't know. What? And he goes, there's so. And I said, why did you ask me that? He goes, oh, I just think about things like that. You know, he just observed things, categorized things, accounted for things. And this was a painter that was just doing outstanding work. And I thought, oh, I want to be like him, you know, just really paying attention to what's going on around me. So, and all the best nature writers tend to have this trait also. They all tend to have really great attention to detail. You know, when one of them writes about a deer, you know everything. I mean, you're literally touching that deer with your brain by the time you're done reading that poem, or by the time you're done looking at the painting of a deer done by a nature painter. So, you know, all that stuff's really important. Okay, so at each step of this creative process that I'm going to talk about, I break things down into smaller activities. I use what I call task analysis. And that's a series of steps I follow. And again, it may be conscious, it may be deliberate, it may not be, but they're always done. I like to think of each stage as I go through in chunks. I don't say I'm in the prep stage or I'm in the this stage, but yet I'm doing things that I know fit within each of the, you know, one of those stages. And to be honest with you, Mark, I really didn't intentionally set out to analyze. When I started writing, I didn't set out to analyze the way I was going to do things because I was too busy writing. But as more people started asking me, well, how do you do that? How do you come up with that idea? How do you develop this? I started really recording my processes and digging deeper into how I went about my writing. So now I'm being asked in these interviews to delve a lot deeper into the progression of my ideas. So that's where I developed the idea of putting together this task analysis piece, especially because everybody that you're going to be interviewing in the future is going to be doing these overarching, be looking at this overarching theme. And they're all going to be following these steps, whether they really think, you know, they're not going to say, oh, I've got a checklist here, I'm going to be on so-and-so. They're just going to go ahead and do the process. But each one of these steps will be followed at some point in that process by them, whether they're really thinking carefully about it or not. There's commonly known as 4 stages of creativity. Now, some people argue 5. They call that one evaluation. And personally, for me, evaluation, which a lot of people normally think of as an end game, is actually one that's interwoven into any, either the, you know, the other sections, at least for me. So the 4 steps are preparation. And let me just list them off, and then I'm going to get into detail about what they are. There's preparation, there's incubation, illumination, and then there's one called translation or implementation. And these steps are used with photography, they're used with playwriting, they're used with painting. You probably are starting to feel that little tingle of the hair standing up on your arms, aren't you, Mark, thinking, wow, okay, I know I do, you know, this prep stage, and I know I do this what stage, and
I do a lot of this, and I don't give it the more formal names that you have, which is fine, of course, but I find that the folks who have become more mature in their writing, they start realizing this by accident, or maybe just because they checked into other people and realized, hey, I need to put together something a little bit more formal as a routine. So when you become more mature in your craft, that maturity doesn't mean 35 years. It could be like yourself, 4 years. Anybody who's doing this, they already become mature in their craft because now they have a basic plan. They have some basic ideas. They have some organization. I've talked to some artists. They have some strange objections to this. Well, that's counter to my organic feeling. Well, guess what? You can be a gardener and you can cordon off certain parts of your land to just to grow certain things. That's an artificial construct. That's not what nature says, but you can still grow things in that construct. Guess what? You could do the same thing with creativity. No one says that organization and a plan is contrary to being organic. It just simply means that you now have a better chance to use the time you have available because we only have so much time. So a process like yours, it makes sense, and I believe it works.
I believe it works too, but I'm also an outlier in that I can't write from blank to blank o'clock. I know that there are writers who are very famous. They always wrote, they got up at 8 o'clock in the morning, they sat down and they wrote until noon, and then they drank whiskey the rest of the day. That's great for them. I'm more power to them. I'm glad that that works, but I can't write from blank to blank o'clock. I have to feel the need to write, to work on my poetry. And I have to have something to say or something to expand on. I never know when that's going to come. That's why I keep a recorder by my bed at night, because if I'm up at 2 o'clock in the morning, I may be pacing back and forth for 15 minutes in the living room, just blasting my voice into that thing, getting all these ideas down, and then go back to bed and sleep. My thoughts have to want to come to light, or I have to have an incredible need to purge something negative in my head. Or I have a need to express some beauty that just bowled me over during the day. You know, I may have heard a song or something or seen a movie, and I'm just thinking, wow, I just can't get that image out of my head. I have to do something with that. And it's not always at night. It could be I'm in the grocery store picking up celery, and all of a sudden it hits me, wow, that image, you know, it's still there. It's kind of, boinking in my head. So I have to do something with that. So I do, I'm kind of scientifically laying this out, but that's not, people do this whether they know they're doing it or not.
And I agree. I remember one of the first funny things that I learned when I was in basic training in the Air Force, and the instructor would yell at us and he'd say, how the heck can you guys not march? It's because you're overthinking it. In fact, you're just thinking about it at all. Why don't you just let yourself naturally walk, and you'll be able to see the cadence, and then you can go from there. But you start thinking about it, and you hear my voice, and I'm yelling, and somehow this interrupts everything. Let yourself go and do it. And he was right. I thought at first he was like being an idiot, and then later on I'm like, he is right. Because when I don't think about it anymore, I can keep up and do what I'm supposed to do. And we all became a unit that way. And it was ironic, a very deep thing got conveyed by a giant guy from Texas who's yelling all day long. But he imparted some interesting lessons, and that was the first one I learned.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it. Getting yelled at is a powerful motivator. It really is. I do allow myself to be flexible in that regard. Like I said, to get rid of the fear of whatever, which is one of that's one of those things that you talked about in one of your podcasts. You talked about writing as therapy recently, and yes. that was a very powerful podcast. If people haven't listened to that, they may want to go back and do that, because that's a really good one. Another thing that I do that I know a lot of my photographer friends do, and some painter friends, they do each stage over and over until things come to fruition. You know, this isn't, when I say that people do these steps, I don't mean like a step ladder. People are going to go back and forth and in and out. This is all interwoven, and you may be on prep stage with this one poem, and you may be on stage three with, you know, five others, and there's all sorts of multitasking going on and everything. This is not a poetry reading podcast, but I'm going to pull examples of lines from my work and refer to some of them to illustrate some of these certain points, so
yes,
that people know I'm not really crazy.
I think that's great, and I invite that. No problem at all.
I'm not being Poindexter here and laying all this out. And I also ask listeners to bear in mind that each step doesn't, like I just said, doesn't occur in isolation. There's no set order to each step within each stage. They're all in a constant state of flux, but they are all going to be necessary components of producing a finished product. They really are. As a matter of fact, changing things up and doing things out of order is often practiced by creative people. So, you know, that's another way to look at it. People say, well, I don't do this. Well, yeah, you actually do. You may not do it in the order in which I'm going to be presenting it, but those things are in there somewhere. Obviously, you can't have a completed poem before you thought about what you're going to write about.
I would say that's correct. But I know we have some folks out there that this is probably either a shock to them or this news to them, that there might actually be a plan or a program behind what's being done creative. A lot of times folks have that fallacy that, you know, it all came to them in a dream, or it just suddenly happened. That's actually more rare than folks realize.
It is rare, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. I have written poems in when I'm asleep. And then that's another reason for that recorder, because the first poem that I composed in my sleep, I remembered half of it when I woke up, and I was mad because I couldn't remember the other half. And of course, the other half was, you know, was the brilliant conclusion. So, you know, that has stayed with me. But like I said, obviously you can't have a completed poem before you thought about what you're going to write about. But if you always come up with a poem title before you write a poem, you might want to consider leaving a title out until you're done. I mean, that's just one way to change things up. There's all sorts of ways to do things. So anyway, that being said, I'm going to get a little bit into the four steps. I'm going to start with preparation, because I think people will start seeing themselves in this now that I'm going to lay it out in a different way.
I believe so.
You have to feed your brain and your heart. Okay. So there are several ways that you can do that. You can be a lifelong learner, well traveled, or preferably both. I have to respond to certain experiences in the quickest way possible. So here's an example. Cathedral's a poem that I wrote on my phone just before Johnny Rivers' concert. I was sitting in a 1930s theater with my friend, and the concert was just about to begin. And I started looking at the architecture, specifically at the windows and the ceiling. Very retro, very beautiful, very majestic. And I thought, here's this wild man. And Johnny Rivers is a wild man. If you guys think that slow dancing's, you know, that little sweet song is the real Johnny Rivers, you've never seen Johnny Rivers. Here's this wild man about to come out and perform. And we're all going to be sitting in this solemn-looking place. And we're all sitting here, and we're going to be listening to his musical sermon. And this place truly does look like a cathedral. So one of the lines in my poem was electrified guitar plays as a carillon of a cathedral. I mean, that's just a line that I pulled out of this poem that I sat there and wrote. And so all these steps, this prep, this, that, I think I might change one word when I got it home and I actually transcribed it onto my computer. But I sat there and wrote the whole thing. So sometimes these things happen rapid pace.
Yes.
And also at the prep stage, your curiosity starts to take hold. You know, you start the what ifs. And I tend to write a lot of what ifs. I have the great what ifs in my experiences. And anybody that's read my book Pairings knows, yes, I like to put those what ifs out there.
I read a few of your fiction pieces in that book where I kept saying to myself, yeah, she's really using this what if to the maximum, because that's not my way of going about things. But I'm glad that you did it, because then the world wouldn't have that what if stuff, because I don't even do it at all. So it's great that somebody can take something like that and then make some really interesting and original stories out of it. So that's excellent.
Well, there's not a lot of science fiction pieces in there. There's a few, but I am a science fiction fan. So the whole idea of what ifs has always been a real strong sort of thing for me. I was influenced as a child by The Twilight Zone and things like that, and Alfred Hitchcock, and they always have that little twist and turn in those stories, or some message that's kind of a what if sort of thing. So I grew up with those. So those tend to be part of what I am. But anyway, I'd written this other poem called 9/11, and it was a what if story. And this is the true part. My husband was due to fly out that day. He was going to Seattle. But I wrote a poem about a woman who actually lost her husband in that tragedy and how she handled it in the aftermath. And I wasn't trying to be morbid. I was just releasing the tension that I felt on that day, because I found out about 9/11, and then all the televisions in all the classrooms in the school where I worked were on, and everybody was glued to the TV, and I couldn't get a hold of my husband. And I couldn't get a hold of my husband for 6 hours.
Wow.
And I didn't know if he was in I had no idea where he was. Well, it turns out that he worked in a government building, and they had sent everybody home that day as a precautionary measure. But I never called the house. This is back before cell phones, too. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have, I don't remember that we had cell phones at the time. But I remember just being so worried all day long. And I thought, oh my gosh, what if I had found out something different? So I wrote that poem about that. Let's see, this is also, the prep stage is also where all your interests come into play. I mean, people write about what they know, and they also write about what they want to write about, what they like to write about. Some people like mysticism, and some people want to write about love, and some people want to write about politics. It just depends. And I may not like a whole topic, but I may like one aspect of a topic, or address or allude to that one aspect. For instance, I wrote a poem about a bad or failing, it was actually a bad marriage, a failing marriage, but rather than writing the entire history of the miserable event, I took one aspect of it, and I wrote this poem called Silent Meal. This is what happened after a woman got a cell phone and then proceeded to use it to text all day and to play games at the expense of her relationship with her husband. And this actually was, I prepped this, Mike and I were out at the little Chinese buffet place we like to eat on Wednesdays, and this was actually going on. This woman was sitting at the table with her husband, and she was on her phone, looking down at her phone the whole time, with her finger just, and I thought, oh my God, that poor man. He just sat there, and basically, the last line is something like, as he sat at the table with her alone. And I thought, wow, you know, so I was very interested in that interplay or uninterplay between those two people. I thought that was rather
I think it's touching on a big part of society these days. That sort of happens a lot, and it's a cautionary tale for all of us to not allow some moments to slip away because of that, because you can always get back to that thing later. So I think we all probably need reminding of that. So thank you for writing that.
Welcome. Another thing that people do during this time, whether they want to believe it or not, is they do planning. You know, they kind of reason things out and they plan things. I wrote a poem that actually took quite a bit of planning. I don't know, it's the longest poem that I wrote. It's 3 pages long and it took a lot of research. It's called Year Among the Stars. It describes the developmental growth of a little boy from birth to 1 year of age. And I interspliced it with the main constellations that are present in the night sky during each month. And I had to know the stages of the night sky, and I had to know all my developmental stages for each month in order to be able to pull off this poem. And it's about him getting exposed. He's had some immunizations, but not enough of the phases. You have to get several stages of inoculation before you're considered inoculated. Yeah. He hadn't had them all. He got exposed to measles. As a result, something happened to him. I won't go into that, but a section from that to give you an idea. October, Aquarius the Water Bearer. I took Aquarius the Water Bearer because that's who is that's the brightest constellation in the October sky. It's not zodiac. It's actually astronomy was where I went with this. Splendid and bright, 6 months of baths still haven't curbed the desire to splash. To Rex, it's funny, slamming down small bath toys in the water. So I made his behavior at that point, at that 6 month point, which kids actually do that at 6 months, kind of interspliced that with the whole idea of the water bearer. And at each month, there's something that happens that's interspliced along with a description of one of these constellations. So, if I do the prep stage when I'm reading other people's work, when I'm looking at my incomplete poems, I use it when I get writer's block. I just noodle around, you know, guitarists noodle around their guitars. Mm-hmm. I noodle around with word gathering, you know, and thoughts and things like that. Another thing I do for prep is I had, it's whittled down quite a bit, but I tend to add to it every once in a while. I took all these old piles of quotes and notes that I had from way back when, and I got those things purged first when I started writing. I got all those things that I used to worry about and all those things that I used to think, oh, I wonder what that means, out of the way, and what does that word mean? Got those things put in there. And now I mostly write about my reaction to new things. So, again, that's part of that writing is therapy, Mark, that you were talking about. So at this stage also I do an action. A lot of people do an action called gathering words to address an idea. Okay, I don't know where all these words come from all these different people, but they obviously have to gather them together and they have to make some sense of them within the page they're writing.
I do is I use a thesaurus a lot, and I try to encourage people to use it a lot because sometimes you don't want to repeat yourself, and this is the only way you're going to be able to not repeat yourself is to go in there and find something different.
Well, and it's interesting that you brought that up because this thesaurus is and has been since high school my bosom buddy. Roger was a brilliant man writing this. And but I know that when I first started writing, my husband would look at my work and he'd say, well, okay, he goes, why don't you use, have you thought about using this word here? And I said, well, no, I've already used that word in the poem. He goes, you know, you can use a word more than once. And I go, well, no, I really like to try and mix it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I do like the nuance of the thesaurus. It's nice to be able to pick a word that is very, very specific to a feeling, an emotion, a thought, and the thesaurus allows you to do that. It also breaks things down by parts of speech, and I think that's really important too. So that's one of those tools of the craft, though. You know, you have your paper, pencil, dictionary, thesaurus, your computer, your brain, heart, and your soul. I mean, those are all your pieces.
I honestly use that more than anything else. I even use a thesaurus more than I use a dictionary.
Well, and that's great. I mean, I wish more people would use one because I think, I'm just a lifelong learner. So, you know, I like to use new words. And speaking of that, I am an avid crossword puzzle doer also, and I learned a word in a crossword puzzle, and I didn't know what it meant, so I looked it up, and the word was lambent, and I thought, oh, that's kind of a cool word. I think I'm going to have to use that one in a poem. So I wrote a poem. Once I had the definition set in my head, I thought about, this is just the prep part of this poem. I thought about places where candlelight's used. I thought, well, okay, there's catacombs in Italy. And I made sure I knew what a catacomb was. And then I started developing a list of burial sites. So that was part of my prep for this poem tomb that that's my real example. That's kind of be the running thread through the rest of these steps. Sometimes I start with titles if a topic really tickles my sensibilities. I try and think of the best way to say that. I guess I think of titles as the main idea of a report and the poem itself as the supporting details. Do I sound like a language arts teacher when I say
no,
that?
No, because you know I literally wrote an entire article just on titles. Because I am a title fanatic, mainly because
you are
my own creation of poems, particularly more than any other genre, is that if you don't have that title right, I don't care how much the rest of the body of the poem is fine. You've now really hurt yourself because it's a marketing piece. It's a calling card. Sometimes it's the right direction for a person to go because they read the title and they go, yeah, I want to continue with this versus, you know, the title of this poem is nature. The title of this poem is dog. I literally have to tell people all the time, get another title because this isn't a title. This is this complete silliness and you're harming what you're doing. So I'm a real fanatic about that.
I'm glad you brought that up because I have a perfect example of how that could have gone badly. Again, back to 9/11, I wrote another poem about 9/11. It was about, and I can't remember their names right off the bat. They're these two really heroic men who carried a woman in a wheelchair down all those flights of stairs and out of the building right before the towers fell.
Wow.
That's a true story. But anyway, I titled it Batman, and because they were superheroes to me. And I wrote about how their mothers had always taught them to look up, you know, pie in the sky and, you know, reach for the stars and do all this. So they were always taught to be looking up. But on that day, they were focused on looking down. And I thought, okay, this doesn't quite say what I want it to say. So I added the word recalculating. So the name of the poem is Batman Recalculating, because Batman did have to recalculate what he's were doing that day. So that's where I added a word, and it made all the difference.
To me, it makes the biggest difference of any of the genres. So I preach it all the time because not only do I practice it, I think that unlike any other genre, the title of a poem is absolutely essential. If you screw that up, you might ruin all your chances of getting published. You might ruin your chances of being selected for a prize in writing, because if it comes down to a tiebreaker, hey, the body of this person's work is really good, and so is that other one. What do you think they're going to go to? They're going to go to the title. Yeah, this sounds more poetic. I'm going to give this person a prize. So I think that what happens with folks is they don't give enough credence to it, mainly because it's wind up being one of those last items. So they do all this work for days and weeks on writing a great poem. They never consider what the title was. And then when they come to it, they just give it, let me just throw it on there and send it out. And this is what messes them up.
That's good advice. That's good advice. I'm going to keep that advice, especially when I submit things to Aerial Chart. I'm teasing you. I'm going to do that all the time. You're my mentor. You're my teacher.
Even though I wrote the article, and even though this is what I feel, I'm not suggesting that a person needs to know the title immediately, or just to work on the title before anything. I'm just simply suggesting that in the course of however they put that thing together, make sure they're giving the same kind of attention to the title as they're doing to the rest of the body of work. If that means that it takes them 3 more days to complete the poem, because it's like, hey, Joe, man, I wrote this awesome poem, but I can't figure out the title. Well, spend some time figuring out the title then, but please don't send it out with Forest, Light. I mean, these are ridiculous titles. I mean, Humor. I mean, these are the titles, the real titles I've gotten. I'm like, you folks, you got to be serious here. I was telling someone the other day to make this a bit of a joke, but it's true. I told this poet, I said, listen, you're not aware of this because you don't get to see and read hundreds of poems every year like I do, okay? But in 2018, I stopped counting on poems I received called Nature. But when I stopped counting, I was at 27. So at that point, I got 27 poems over the course of that year that were just called Nature. Some of them were haikus, some of them were larger pieces, doesn't matter, they were called Nature. Every one of them I had sent back. And if anyone knows anything about Aerial Chart, when I send something back for something like that, it's not a rejection, it's simply about, can you go pause for a moment, like you should have did before, and figure out what this title should be, because the rest of the poem is great, this title is horrible, and I won't let it go if you don't change it. But I don't consider it a rejection, I consider it just like a creative pause.
Okay, yeah, and that does make perfect sense. That really does make perfect sense. And I really recognize that with the Batman poem. I really, this isn't quite what I want to say. I mean, there's more to the Batman on this than just the name Batman. So, yeah, so I hear you on that. Okay, the second stage is incubation. That's when you kind of sit on things just like a chicken. You're reflecting, you're starting to fixate on an idea, you're really starting to speculate. That's where my what ifs really start kicking into gear. This is a stage, though, this is not a stage I can control in terms of a timeline.
Right.
Nor can anyone. This is called the not thinking part of the process. And that not thinking is critical. It's not a matter of learning more technique. It's just a matter of letting the ideas stew in their own juices. It's the sleep on it stage, whether it's the title or whether it's the poem. It's the sleep on it stage. And you're constantly searching for ideas and getting, for me, I get rid of what doesn't turn me on. I try and make new connections. I need to give things that are interfering with the process time to settle or disappear. Remember that old Sesame Street song, one of these things is not like the other? This is where I get those things out of there. You know, I take out whole lines that don't have anything to do with what I'm doing. And sometimes the reason I do that is sometimes I've changed the entire direction of poems going. I've done this a couple of times when I have a lot of lines about something and they all sound stupid, but I've got a few lines about something that's really good. And I think, hey, why am I writing about this mundane stuff here? You know, I'm going to take these three good lines instead of those seven crummy lines, and I'm going to write something that's brilliant. So, you know, there you go.
No, it's part of what a lot of us do, so I recognize it right away.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to start recognizing themselves, even though at the beginning they might have said, I don't do any of this. Yeah, you'll find out you do. You know, people in offices walk away and go to the water fountain and get away from their desk and everything. But we who are writers, we tend to still weigh a paper and revisit it later. It's the same sort of thing. You know, the other thing that people do at this stage is they mull things over and let the mind wander around the topic. You know, back to my tomb poem, you know, at first I thought about catacombs and developed that list of burial sites. And then I started thinking about the characteristics of burial sites. What are the essences? How are they related? How are all these burial sites? What does this mean in the bigger picture? So that was kind of my thought process at that time. Then the third stage is illumination. And that's the one, that's the big aha, okay, regarding tomb. It hit me. I needed to look at the burial sites from a certain perspective. That's when I added the very last tomb. That, my friend, is what finally tied it all together. And I'll explain that a little bit more in the last step. But once I decided to look at it from a certain perspective, that was all it took to be able to finish it up, at least in my head, at least with some phrases and things on paper and some ideas and things. I decided, you know, I call it the radiance of the direction that I'll be going. That's what I call this step, since it's illumination, but I call it the radiance because I see light at the end of the tunnel. I see that things are, I see that if I just keep moving forward with this, something's going to click. That's why I keep the recorder by my bed, keep a notepad in my car. I use the heck out of the notes feature on my iPhone. I mean, because I never know when that radiance is going to come along. It's almost like a strong urge to sneeze. You know, it's going to come out whether you want it to or not, or think of it like a flash of lightning. And I'm sure there's a thousand artistic ways that you could talk about the illumination of the light bulb coming on in your head. Yes. Some people, yeah. This is where a theme, and I define a theme as a subject and opinion, or a theme or a message starts coming through. At this point, too, you know, I really may not have, I may write a poem and I may think, well, I want to write a poem that gives a message about, but I don't really have the message clear. This is where everything starts to kind of gel and come along. It's also where I elaborate and I start using metaphors and similes and images start to unroll. Back to Batman recalculating. I remember on that day, on the day of 9/11, I remember the silence in the sky on those ensuing days. Do you remember that, Mark, with no planes up there?
Well, I remember a lot of it because I was living in Arizona at the time. They sent us home because when the towers fell down, we lost our servers to General Motors' financial computers that I was working at the time. And I wound up going back, and then my radio guy called me. He goes, let's do an interview, Mark. I can't get anybody else on the phone. And I just did an interview with him about my technology book a few weeks before. So I literally gave an interview on 9/11, having to try to comment about what was going on.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I just remember the silence. I just remember because we live close to, I worked close to McConnell Air Force Base. And that first day, of course, they had those big jet turbines going in case they needed to take over, you know, because they never knew what else was going to be coming out of the sky. Yep. So military, you know that.
Yeah, the
military
was ready to. So, yeah, they had to make sure that nothing else was going to be out there, and they were ready to shoot anything
down. And ready to go on a moment's notice just in case. But I remember the silence. And so there's a line in 9/11. I said Batman recalculating, but I meant my poem 9/11. there's a line in 9/11 about the bars and taverns becoming churches. And that's basically the way it felt. Everywhere was a church. I mean, everywhere was silence. Everywhere was solemnity. Everywhere was prayer. I mean, there was all that stuff going on at that time. So that's where that line came in there. And that's where, I elaborated on that at this particular stage. Another thing that happens at this stage is abstract words like love turn into concrete words. And again, you use pictures, metaphors, similes, whatever. I wrote a poem called Man in the Bath, and it's basically about a man who commits suicide and talks about red algae bloom. At the end, there's a shriek of a gull as his deed is exposed, or rather someone in his household turning on the light and discovering him, So those kind of things started. I start thinking, that's what that means. Because before I had written, okay, if you've got a man who commits suicide in the bathtub, and how am I going to make that a little more picturesque without making it gross?
Yeah. Wow.
And so I thought about a seashore, and I thought about, waves hitting pilings and stuff like that. So that's all this word gathering started and everything. And when it finally came together, rather than just talk about this guy's dead, I made it into something that people would be able to think through and relate and think, he's, the rocking in the waves, he's rocking in the bathtub, the red algae bloom after he slits himself up and everything. It just kind of came together. This another thing that happens during this phase, and particularly for me, is a lot of phrases. People start pulling together words that they use, that they experience with their senses, and the synesthesia poets use this all the time. They're constantly addressing, assigning a feeling to something, and they may have a painting along with a poem or something, but they literally feel their poems. I really don't know how to describe it. I'm more of a visual person, so my poem has to look a certain way rather than feel a certain way. I mean, it feels, but does that, am I making any sense on that?
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense to me, because what a lot of poets, especially because they're creators of art, there's certain things that they do that override other things, and it makes them different than the other artists. Like, you're more visual, and that's great, especially since I publish a lot of your work, and I like to have that as a part of a component of my monthly magazine, where I'm not. So it's good to have these various contrasts. It's good to have somebody that wants to be more visual, and somebody wants to be more cerebral. I got some folks that want to be straight emotional, and others, they simply want to be literal. So it's great to have all these different facets of humanity in there, because if you just have one, that one overriding theme all the time, it becomes to a person who's reading it as the same note, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much. But I can picture the people you're talking about. I mean, and I admire all of their work so much. I mean, there are so many different types of things out there. There's so many ways to write poetry. I don't want everybody to write like me, and I don't want to write like somebody else. So I think it's cool that people come from different phases. But regardless of which brand of cereal you're talking about, they still go through these stages.
Yes.
They just do. They're all going to go through them at some point. The closest that I got, well, I won't say it was the closest I got, but as far as synesthesia, because like I said, I'm not very good at that, but I can kind of picture things. And I wrote this poem called Neptune's Choir, and I had recently submitted to a gal named Carr Cooper. She does interviews, and she does the backstory on poems. And she said, how did you come up with this? And can I see your first draft? And your ensuing drafts and all this. So I sent her all that stuff. And, but I wrote it after the Florida floods in honor of the victims that died there. And one of the things that the phrases that kept going around in my head that was kind of an aha moment for me at this point, I said, okay, I wrote that they were singing through life. And I thought, you know, that is such an alive vision of people singing, because it's such an active thing to do, to sing. And I thought, okay, so that makes their death seem all that much more tragic. Yeah. And unnecessary, you know, the fact that they were singing through life and this wave came, you know, and basically drowned out their voices. And so that's kind of something that came up during the stage that I recognized as being in the stage. A lot of times I don't recognize, I mean, I could probably go back and maybe pick up a few things for these different steps, but, you know, you just, or no, I don't, like I said, I don't sit there with a checklist and figure that out. The last step is translation or implementation. This is where it gets fun. This is the place where I do what I call cutting a hole in the walls of my thinking. Okay, this is the actual make it stage. This is the big create. I really start to manipulate words and thinking about my audience. And audience is a real, you know, audience and voice are two really, really big writing convention things that people need to keep in mind. But start thinking about my audience. And that's the same thing that you and I and everybody else that ever has a poem out there does when we look at submission guidelines. You know, we're thinking about the audience. Is this the audience for this poem?
Yeah, it's real important, because it could really alter whether you're going to get acceptance or rejected to a certain degree.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I've realized once or twice, I just sent them a thing that I really, you know, sometimes you're kind of on the fence. You don't know. You're thinking, well, maybe they'll have an extra page left over and they'll put it in there. But I really do try and be careful with submission guidelines, because it's their time is as valuable as mine. So, you know, I'm not going to play around with that. I had written this poem called Louisiana Electric Blues. It's my tribute poem to the great blues guitarist Buddy Guy. Yes. And one line read, he played through walls. And I had been thinking about, you know, I thought about the aha, and I thought, what is it really sets Buddy Guy out? What has made him so popular all these years that I, you know, that Mike and I will go see him 8-10 times in concert? I mean, if he comes to Wichita twice a year, I'm there twice a year. Let me put it that way. He's in his 80s and he just, he really rocks it. But anyway, he's loud, but he plays loudly, but he also is a real ambassador for race relations. I started thinking about that and I thought, okay, how can I make that sound more poetic? Well, finally put it together. He played through walls. He played through the walls of race. And he played through the walls, so that, you know, because he was loud and people could hear him. So that's kind of why that line was in there. Another thing that happens during this stage is, at least for me, I make what I'm saying accessible. Okay. I wrote a poem called Homeless Souls, and my meaning in that poem is very clear, even though there's a great deal of fancy adjectives in there. Yeah, well, there is. I mean, I've got barbaric beast and this and that and barbaric. I mean, it just goes on with the thesaurus really was my friend that day. I'm telling you, I found all these cool words. But the first few lines lay out the premise. When God forgives Lucifer and all of hell is emptied, when the entry doors to that fetid place are closed and locked forever, what will happen to the still unrepentant? And of course, that's one of those what ifs
Yes.
Back to the one of the what ifs. But I also had a field day with writing the words, but they had to be accessible. I couldn't pick words that were so obscure that people would go, what, you know, people just get turned off by that.
Yeah, they do, because if you're interrupting the flow of, I got them now, and then you throw some crazy phrase or some crazy word that they have to go look up, even when they find the answer, it kind of messes up the whole experience.
It really does. I try not to do it, but if it's going to be, if I'm going to do an alliteration line, I might get a little fancy with the word sometime, just so people want to look it up because they think the alliteration's kind of cool.
Yeah, I do.
But
anyway.
The work, like, you know. Yeah, if the work isn't meaningful to others, nobody's going to read it. And as you said in your first podcast, the craft has to feel that it's worthy. You know, it has to be worthy of being read. So if it won't be worthy of being read if I get too weird and out there and everything. But on the other hand, you also talked about fear and not being afraid to be different. So I'm thinking, well, you know, instead of using the same word, I think I will take a chance and maybe up it just a little bit. I try not to go too deep into the sorry. You know, they're kind of in order there. So I kind of try and pick one that maybe has a little less syllables, you know, or something. When you're talking about rhythm, you have to be careful about that and pick the right one. Eventually the written piece comes out. I mean, that happens at this stage. You start getting stuff on paper, and back to my poem Tomb again. I finally assembled, once I got my list of all those burial sites, I assembled all the tombs and I sorted from the most to the least majestic. And then of course, because I had that aha moment, I had ended up with the most majestic to tie it all together. So I basically start with Taj Mahal, which is the grandest tomb that I know of on the planet.
It's definitely, unless you can count one of the pyramids, it's definitely one of the biggest ones, yes.
Well, the pyramids are in there. The catacombs are in there because, remember, I started with the word lambent.
Yeah.
And I even got down to the mass graves, you know, unnamed mass graves of people and the tombs of people who were buried that had no, you know, this, that, and the other. And then I've got this little space there, and then I talk about the grotto where Christ was buried. And so it's kind of a circular poem. You know, I start with the most majestic and I end up with the really most majestic. So, that was a really cool poem to write, but I had to do a lot of this planning stage from the prep and everything back for that. Let's see, I had feelings there and I strengthen any ideas I have, try and fill out lines with appropriate adjectives here again. You know, your thesaurus comes in really handy for that.
It really does.
Trying to use imagery, adding clarity to each line, because here again, it has to be clear or else it's not worthy and nobody's going to read it. So as fancy as I want to get sometimes, people need to read, you know, my great aunts aren't going to read a bunch of real stuff that they can't understand, so I have to make it clear for them. Excuse me. And this is where I make sure my line breaks and force the rhythm and make each line pop. And I always look for the best form to convey the ideas. You know, I mentioned earlier I give a look to a poem, and for some reason that's really important to me. And one of the poems that's in pairings is Weather the Night.
Yes.
And that's that poem kind of in the Ginsberg style with a more modern version of the Ten Commandments. But I didn't want to just list that out like I did with Tomb. With Tomb, I just listed everything and then put that last paragraph as a separate little piece there. So I put it in the form of a cross, which is kind of an interesting way to look at it.
I like when people do that. I wish I get more of that in magazine, but less and less people do that sort of thing. So I was happy to see it, and I try to encourage it whenever I can.
Yeah, well, I have to pick an image that makes sense, though, to me. I wrote a poem called Uniforms. It's not a very long poem. And I did a similar style with that one. It's about people from different professions wearing uniforms, like a cop wears blue and stands tall and keeps the law, and the hospital person does this and blah, blah, blah. And then I have about six blank lines. And then the last two lines are about the homeless, and they get their uniforms out of the trash. And rather than standing tall, they hang their head and they feel the scorn. And that's not my personal opinion of homeless, but that's how they're perceived by society. They're removed some. So I wrote it intentionally as a social statement that here's these people that are admired, and here's the homeless person down here. And this is, they're set aside. So, hopefully people will. It's a very short poem with a very big message, and I hope people got the message based on how I tried to write it, so I was bagging on homeless people, wrote it just as a social statement itself.
I don't think anyone's going to take that. I see what you're talking about, because in a way, how a person lives, especially if you're homeless, in a way, what they're wearing, or maybe even what they're gathering from the trash or from donations, becomes like their uniform. And what does that affect in terms of their outlook to the world? It's a great theme.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. And I'm almost done here with this, but this is the place also where I read stuff aloud. And this is where I really kind of clean it up, and I know that you and I've talked about how I write things out and then I bring it down and I do dictation on my computer, mm-hmm. because I need to hear how it sounds. And that's where I, make sure my line breaks and force the rhythm and all that kind of stuff. And the rhythmically sounds fine. This is where I really peer closely at my word choice also. Why this word, why that word? That's where, again, Peter Roget, God bless him, glad he was born. He gives so much nuance and shades to the language. It's just wonderful. But the great thing about, to wrap it up, the great thing about all this is that I've developed a way of thinking that can be used with different styles. Because like I said, I'm a lifelong learner, and that's very important to me. And one of my New Year's resolutions was to learn to write more in different styles, like Ghazal and Pantoum and Kirial, or however you print Kirial. I can spell it. I'm not sure that's pronunciation for it. But as I learn, like I said, I'm a student. I'm a student of the craft. I'm learning. I need a process to learn, just like everybody needs a process to learn. And a task analysis is a good way to break things down and do things by step. Small is better. So if you break things down and you're struggling, particularly if you're struggling with one part of it, just think, did I do everything that I need to do in the prep stage? Because if I didn't, maybe I need to go back and revisit that part just a little bit and kind of think about some of the things that people do during their prep stage, what creative people do, whether they're photographers or nature writers or painters or whatever, and really delve into what did I leave out? What could I improve at this part? So that's basically what I do. And I hope that's helpful to people. And I apologize for all my stumbling around with my words, but I really want to pick up.
This is an interview, and there's no stumbling. In fact, I'm more worried about somebody that comes on, and everything that they say from the beginning to the end is absolutely perfect, because I find, for me anyway, perfection to be suspicious, because if we're, if we're going to be human, we should be stumbling around a little bit. We should be looking around and not always having the most perfect or consistent thought. That's not bad. That's a person, even as they're being interviewed, trying to create, trying to struggle to get something out to someone that might impart a piece of information or wisdom. This is what we're supposed to do as artists. And quite frankly, if we did this more as people, we would probably have a more peaceful world.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I don't have all the answers. I just have a process that might be helpful to some people to be able to pull everything together, because I want people to pull everything together. I want to read what people are writing. So, and if they're struggling, and if this helps in any way, shape, or form, or helps them identify all these parts where they do well, they may not need a lot of improvement. They may do most of it really well. But it helps to be able to identify that also, so they can keep doing that.
No, I thank you very much for being on, and I'm convinced that this kind of show is going to really help a lot of folks out there that are creative. And the reason why I say that is because they don't need to sit there with a pad and say, okay, I got these 5 steps from Linda, let me go do this. All they need to do is hear what you have to say and realize there's a good chance that some of the issues I'm having, it's because I haven't looked at this or I haven't looked at that. I need to stand back and look at this, or maybe I need to work more on that. When they hear that, they understand now that they don't have problems because they are not good artists. They have problems because sometimes they're just not putting in the work, or they're not putting in enough patience, or they're simply not sitting back enough and just want to rush things. When they can be a little bit more deliberate and they can see that there is a process, even if they don't want to give it a formal name, that's going to help them become a better communicator. And that's the value in it in itself, just for the whole program, that they now become a better communicator because Linda just told them, well, this is how I do it. And maybe it's more elaborate for me. Maybe it won't be as elaborate for you, but you need to be able to do something more than just think that a dream or random thought or 6 words together is supposed to be perfect. No, you have a little bit more to do, but once you start doing that, you're going to gain the confidence, you're going to gain the insight, and then in the end, you're going to gain a piece of art that you can put out there for all of us to enjoy.
Well, and I'm hoping something that will happen with this first show, it was just kind of laying the whole idea of creativity out, is that you'll get some feedback on some people that say, well, I do this during this stage, you know, things that I hadn't thought of. Like I said, I don't have all the answers. And I know there's a whole bunch of other things that are going on that I'm not thinking about. So if they can add to the idea of what's going on here, that would help everybody too.
I'm convinced that it is. Much. People need to hear this sort of stuff, and I don't really think that people share enough of some of the things behind the scenes. And then that's sort of the story behind the poem, which you did, which is great and still pretty rare, actually. But just the story of how they create, how they are as a creator, or maybe in some instances, because I've had some people tell me behind the scenes, they just don't want to go publicly stating that, you know, I'm missing some pieces and I'm not sure what they are. I'm hoping a program like this, that's going to help fill some of the gaps.
Oh, I hope that. I hope for their sake. I really hope it does too. I hope that it helps a lot. It's going to help me. I need to go back and listen to it myself, remember everything that I said, but it does help. It is going to help. Yeah.
I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being on here, being on our first interview, allowing the show to have a big step forward and what we want to do going forward. And without trying to make a joke out of it, I think a person could be a fireman for 30 years, and when they retire, they might have that title still, but they don't actively do a lot of firefighting anymore. I don't think it's the same with a teacher. I really think that even when you retire, you could keep teaching until the end of your days. And that's exactly what you're doing in this show. And I'm proud to have that, because
thank you very much. That's a wonderful thing. I've enjoyed all the podcasts. Yeah, I've enjoyed all the podcasts. I'm going to keep enjoying them. And you have a great day, and God bless you, sir.
I really do appreciate it. That's Linda Imbler. That is a poet, a fiction writer, a person that not only is a nominated for great awards, but one day they're going to have some great awards in their name because of how dedicated they are. You can find a lot of her books on Amazon, the print books, or you can also find a couple of her electronic versions of books on SomaPublishing.com. So give those a chance, and I think you'll be more than surprised. I think you'll be excited that someone is out there doing something that is not only new, but also in many ways is something that you can relate to. God bless you all, and thank you for being with us here at Strength to Be Human.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.